You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 20 and 93.9 WNYC.
Zadie Smith took the literary world by storm while she was still an undergraduate when her debut novel, White Teeth, was published. Her latest NW is the story of the gritty northwestern multicultural corner of London. It's an ambitious tale of the friendship between two women as they make the transition into adulthood, struggling to both incorporate and to shed the influences of their childhood home. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Zadie Smith back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
So for those of us who don't know London well, who are not natives, how would you describe the area known as NW?
Well, it's, I suppose, famous for being a place of transition in that whoever you meet in London usually tells you they lived in Kilburn at one point or another before moving on to somewhere better or somewhere further away. Has always had massive waves of immigration, but its character changes all the time. Originally, it was a Jewish area. It became Jamaican and Irish. It's now, it's so international, it would be hard to speak of a dominant group.
So it's kind of a melting pot now.
Pretty much.
Would we see it as an area defined by cultural collision? Because of all the different groups?
No, I mean, we don't war on the streets or anything. One of the things about that area is that when you have so much constant change, people get very used to it. You know, we don't experience a shock every time there's a new wave of people arriving because it's been happening for almost 100 years.
And did you grow up there?
Yes, I grew up there, yes.
Do you still have family living there?
My family live there. I still live there half the year. I'm around.
But the other half you live in New York.
Yeah.
So is this novel a return to your roots in a way?
It was a kind of reconsideration. I suppose that the novel itself was quite difficult to write and kind of formally awkward. So in a way, it was giving myself one bit of a break, right? So at least I would have the streets I knew to speak of.
Now, why was it difficult to write? Because, I mean, I understand after having read the book why it was difficult to write. But because did you set yourself a lot of challenges making it difficult to write?
I just had a sense of it as of having a different kind of form. I wanted it to be like a problem play. I guess that's what I set myself in the beginning, a book which is neither a comedy nor a tragedy, but gives you that third feeling that Shakespeare was so good at, that sense of being interrogated by a book one way or another, or interrogated by a play. So that was kind of tricky. I wanted to do things stylistically that I hadn't done before, and that was difficult too.
And at the end of the book, you have a lot of numbered chapters or numbered sections. Is that something you knew you were going to do from the start, or is that something that just came along as you were working on the book?
No, I always had a sense that I wanted each character's story to be told in a way that reflected their view of the world. I thought there was something almost artificial about pressing so many different people's perspectives into one smooth narrative voice. I wanted to allow the characters their own perspective on the world, and Natalie is a kind of, she's the character in that last third of a book, a future-seeking animal. No, she's always thinking of the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So that kind of numbered argument, it became natural.
Now, Natalie was originally named Keisha, but you think of her as Natalie. That's because that's the name she gave herself. And she's one of the two friends who are at the center of this book. The other is Leah. Leah's white. Keisha is a mixed race.
Oh, no, Keisha's black.
Well, in this country, like Obama, she would be considered black, and the same is true in England.
All I mean is that both Natalie's parents are black. They're both Jamaican. She's not mixed race like me.
Leah is what the Brits call a ginger, at least she was as a child.
Yeah.
Can you explain what that is?
Well, yeah, just a redhead. She's a redhead, which in Britain is almost its own ethnic group, particularly in a school where you can get teased quite relentlessly.
Now, why is that? I read about a campaign run by the government trying to teach people not to be prejudiced against gingers.
I have no idea. Maybe because children have a passion for difference. No, they always pick it out and they always make a scene of it. But yes, she's a redhead.
How do Leah and Natalie become friends?
Well, they grow up in the same, what you would call a housing project, what we call a council estate. And they go to a very large and rambunctious school where they're good friends. They pass through it, and then in various ways they grow apart. They go into different lives.
But they're racially different. Sometimes that becomes a problem. Would it be less of a problem in London than it might be elsewhere?
Well, I don't think the problem between those two women in the book is racial at all, really. It's a matter of class, no?
Mm-hmm.
Natalie goes into a different class, becomes in some ways upper middle class, and that is felt as a betrayal by her friend.
Well, she starts off, they both start off in the same class.
Yes.
I laughed at a scene where Keisha is puzzled every time she comes into Leah's kitchen. And here's what she assumes is the radio DJ talking between songs.
Yeah.
This is her first introduction to talk radio.
Yeah, it always strikes me that class is a kind of cocoon. When you're in it, it's almost impossible to comprehend what it's like to be outside of that class or in another class. And I certainly remember as a child, I've never heard radio with people speaking and no music. I remember exactly the shock of realizing that there were people who listened to nothing but talk all day long. You lose any sense of the proportion of a class when you're outside it. And I wanted to try and write a book in which all the classes were remembered.
Leah has older parents. Does that isolate her a little or give her more freedom than she might otherwise have?
Well, she's an only child in the book as well, which is a kind of isolating experience. I think all the kids in the book grew up on a corridor. I grew up that way with lots of people around. And then as you move into adult life, you suddenly find yourself isolated one way or another in your own flat or your own house. And it's meant to be the thing that you aim for and dream about. But something in communal life is also lost.
In this book, the only people you identify by race or ethnicity are the white characters. Why? Is that because if you grow up in a black environment, that's the way you would see the world?
It was completely unconscious, and then halfway through the book I realized I was doing it. I decided to continue it. It's not a particular feature of the book, but it might be interesting for white readers to realize that they're not entirely neutral in the world the way they, I suppose, sometimes consider themselves to be.
Well, yeah, when you buy flesh-colored Band-Aids.
Yes. Yeah.
I have to confess that when we first meet the yuppified Keisha, who is renamed herself Natalie, and her husband Frank, I was assuming Frank was white. He just seemed so Ralph Lauren. It was only when we got to their histories that I realized otherwise.
But that's always so fascinating, though, these kind of cultural markers that people believe make somebody white or somebody black. The only thing which makes anybody white or black physically is a genetic matter. But there's all these other things that we naturally and instinctively bring to it. Frank is a mixed-race man. He may wear a lot of Ralph Lauren, but it hasn't changed his genetic makeup. But that question for Natalie about who is really black or what black really means is a problem all the way through the book, I think.
And then although Leah is white, her best friend Keisha, Natalie, is black, and Leah's married to a black man.
Yes. Yeah, I suppose, I mean, my childhood was extremely mixed in every way. Maybe that's just the way my imagination is structured. It's hard for me to imagine an all-white world or even an all-black world.
He is much more attractive than she is in a lot of ways. Does that make her insecure?
I don't know. You're asking me psychological questions, my characters. I have to confess I don't know the answer. I kind of set them going and then I allow them to live or try to. It's certainly true, yes, her husband is better looking than her. It does seem to create some anxiety in her. I just like the idea of, you don't often hear about female desire for beauty in that sense. Mm. Their own beauty all the time, but the beauty of men is often obscured, so I like to reinsert it into my fiction.
Well, you've said that you really don't want to tell your readers what your characters are all about. You'd rather tell them how the world works?
Did I ever say
did
that?
Did I paraphrase
it? I'm
sorry.
Imagine saying that. I hope I don't think I meant that.
I'm going to have to find the real quote. You do leave stuff out.
Well,
and obviously on purpose.
I think you have to have a little faith in readers. We start as childhood readers and we want everything in every detail. But readers grow up and readers are capable of incredible feats of imagination. And to me, reading is as difficult a matter as writing and should be. It's an act of creation. I just have a lot of respect for my readers and I think they're bright people.
Mm-hmm. You have, it's these two women, much of the plot also involves the pressure to have children. One of them takes birth control pills secretly so she won't have children. They're also trying to sort out their sense of sexuality within marriages. And then you have these men you bring into the picture. I mean, not their husbands, other men who complicate the situation.
Yeah,
there's a murder here.
Yes, there is. I I mean, I didn't mean to suggest that it's only women who have these anxieties or issues. I think for all of my generation, we maybe made decisions, delayed decisions of having families and the kind of things that the generation previously did very early on. It becomes hard to work out what your supposed natural instincts are. Everybody's telling you you have natural instincts, but the further time goes on, you don't think of yourself as an animal with natural instincts. So I was just interested in what that does to a whole generation to find themselves somewhat adrift.
You tell several different stories here, move back and forward in time. Was it difficult to control that structure?
No, I was quite clear. I mean, it's difficult maybe when you're writing, but then when you get to first drafts and second drafts, you have all your material and you can be very controlled and make very particular decisions about how things will be shaped. So by the end, I had the material under my control. And of course, it was so much shorter than anything I'd written before, despite it being heavily spaced out in that edition you have. So it was much easier to handle than 550 or 600 pages like White Teeth. That's a hard thing to keep in your mind at the same time.
In the dialogue you've written in the first section of the book, the speakers never identify. You don't use quotations, just a dash to indicate conversation. But it's a tribute to you that despite that, the reader is never confused about who's speaking. You really had to establish different characters' voices.
I think if dialogue is strong enough, it doesn't need all that architecture. You know, you can say he said, she said, he said, she said hundreds of times a page. But again, readers are capable of understanding
but then
the
you
difference between
that.
People speaking. Yes, but this was a question of different characters. Like with Leah, she's a woman kind of, living in the present, though. She's very indecisive and slightly lost. And when I moved on to a section with Felix, who's a young black man, who's trying to improve his life. He's gone from being a dealer to a mechanic. He has a sense of his life as a kind of film that's playing, no, a kind of story that he's in. So I wanted to give him the full, embellished, you know, 19th century narrative treatment, because that's how Felix thinks of his life, as a great story.
You've talked about the existential crisis people in this book are experiencing. What's an existential crisis?
Well, that's a big subject, but I guess what I was trying to push at was the idea that, you know, for a lot of people in the 20th and 21st century, the idea of not being sure what a self is or what a self consists of, or if one is a completely consistent person, that was a big question in all the arts and in all our lives. But one part which is sometimes neglected is the idea that people of color also have these same crises in the 20th and 21st century. All our art is often concentrated on the idea of positive identity, which is a good thing because people of color need a positive identity like everybody else, but they also suffer from the same anxieties and fears that everybody had in the late 20th century and early 21st century. So I kind of wanted to write a black existential novel. What if we had black characters who weren't only, you know, certain and positive and aspirational, but also unsure and uncertain and lost?
I found that thing that I was referring to. I read it in a review in which the reviewer said that you've said that the job of a novelist isn't to tell us how somebody felt about something, but rather how the world works.
Oh, I don't think that at all anymore. I must have been about 22 when I said it. Youthful foolishness.
And are you past what James Wood called hysterical fiction?
Well, I don't recognize the term because it's too broad to include the kind of people he wants to include. I don't have much in common with Thomas Pynchon, and Thomas Pynchon doesn't have that much in common with Don DeLillo, and on. These are such different particular writers that it's hard to gather under a single term.
So sometimes when you read a review, do you say, what book was that person reading?
No, I always take reviews seriously because I take readers seriously, but one must also know that in criticism there's a need for general terms and general ideas. I write criticism myself, so I know it well. But novels are particular things with particular identities that can't always be caught up in general terms.
And you've been writing criticism for Harper's.
Yes, I just finished, actually. I had to stop because there's only so much work I can get done in a day. But it was a great joy doing it.
And it's been 8 years since your last novel.
Yeah.
Is it because you were doing all these other things and teaching and going back and forth between England and the United States? Or was it just that this novel was just so difficult to complete?
I think I'm slow, for sure. And also I think the kind of publishing ideal of a book every 2 years doesn't suit everyone. You know, I like the idea of a novel that feels to its writer and to its readers, hopefully, essential in some way. And I couldn't do that every 2 years. I don't have that capacity.
Well, have you started another one?
I have an idea for another one, but it's a quite different matter. Some books are very personal and agonizing, and this one was that kind, and others are a kind of entertainment, and I guess the next one is an entertainment, so it's easy to get started.
Zadie Smith is the author of White Teeth, The Autograph Man on Beauty, the essay collection Changing My Mind, and now NW, which is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us
again. Thank you.